Warning, this program will discuss adult themes. Viewer discretion is advised.
Okay, good afternoon. And I think we're ready to begin with our next speaker. I'd like, in introducing Professor John Cutaback, I'd like to begin with what in the bio is usually the last thing, which is the fluff and just the human interest stuff. He blogs on the topic of a philosophy of household at the blog entitled Bacon from Acorns. So I read Bacon and I said, that's it, I like it. I don't even know the rest of it. Don't even know what it's about, but I already like it. Actually, I recommend that blog to you. And I'm very happy to introduce him this afternoon. I'm a priest of the Diocese of Arlington, which encompasses all of Northern Virginia as far west as the West Virginia border. One of the great blessings in our diocese is Christendom College. It's a great place of devotion and has been a source of vocations for our diocese as well. And I think one of the great assets at Christendom College is Dr. Cutaback. He received his PhD in philosophy from the Catholic University of America in 1997. He writes and lectures on various topics, including virtue, culture, natural law, contemplation, and friendship. His book entitled True Friendship, Where Virtue Becomes Happiness, was republished in 2010. He is a Third Order lay Dominican and currently teaches in the philosophy department at Christendom College. He's an avid gardener and hunter and also raises pigs. A swine herd, I guess, okay? And also, I think, make sausage, too. So
and bacon.
Right. So, but he's only going to talk on one of these topics today, okay? So I'm glad to welcome Dr. Cutaback. Please, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Father. Appreciate it. So I think I don't need this, right? Is that right? Turn this one off. Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, Father. That was very generous. I suppose you know you're in Chicago when on every door is the silhouette of a gun with a line through it. Back in Virginia, it's no problem when people bring guns to my presentations, but I suppose they didn't want you to bring any, so maybe they know something I don't. So I'm glad that sign's on the door. It is a very, very special honor for me to be here. I would just say that already. In my time here, I have been humbled, I have been inspired, I have been deeply moved. So thank you very much for asking me to join you. There's nothing so precious as a faithful friend, and no scales can measure his excellence. A faithful friend is an elixir of life. That's from the book of Sirach. The title of my lecture is The Challenge of True Friendship Today. There are many challenges to true friendship in any age, but I think there are particularly some striking challenges to true friendship in our age, and I'd like to look at that a little bit together. But first, the fundamental challenge in any true friendship is this: will we be able to look upon another person with the eyes of love? Will we really be able to look upon another person with the eyes of love. When I say look upon another person with the eyes of love, I mean and truly love with an unselfish, giving heart that puts the other person first. When that is achieved, it's simply a masterpiece. It's a real challenge. In a sense, isn't it the challenge of our life to learn how to love? In a sense, it's so simple, but obviously at the same time, it's rather complex. It demands quite a bit of us. When two people succeed in looking upon one another with true love, and then they share a life together in that love, that's what's called true friendship. Two people that actually, to some real extent, are succeeding in doing this. Doesn't mean that they're perfect, but to some real extent, they are succeeding in loving one another truly and living in that love. That, I suggest, is what true friendship is. I'd like to look at three different challenges. They're interrelated, but they're different. So I'm just going to divide my presentation into three parts. I'm just going to consider in turn each of these three areas of challenge to doing that which we just mentioned. We will have time for discussion afterwards, and I hope that you will save your questions and bring them up. Here are the three challenges. The first is we need to see ourselves as lovable if we are to love. And that's a challenge. We have to see ourselves as lovable if we're going to love. Two, we need to form habits of being together with those that we love. We need to form habits of being together with those that we love. And that's a challenge. And thirdly, we need to avoid having sexual desire distort our vision of love. And that's a challenge. So let's look at each of these three areas. The first, in a sense, is the big one, learning to see ourselves as lovable. I'm going to paint a little picture for you here, and I think in this picture, we'll be able to see the problem. I am convinced that the truth of this matter is rather simple and rather profound. We learn how to love another when someone loves us first. We learn how to love another when someone loves us first. Consider, if you would, the power of the following scenario. We come into the world, and as our consciousness dawns, nay, remarkably, perhaps even before our consciousness is dawning, someone or someones are looking at us and saying, even if not in words, "This world will never be the same now that you're here. My life will never be the same now that you are here. You are good, and I love you." Ladies and gentlemen, I suggest that therein is, in a sense, the most creative aspect of parents towards their children. That in loving them in that way, they give their children the courage to be. They belong. They are lovable. They are home. True love is always creative. And right from the start, that's what it can look like in that beautiful scenario where the love of parents does that from the very beginning for child. So the child learns to see himself through another's eyes. I obviously am lovable because, lo, I am being loved. There is no surer testimony to me of my lovability than that I am, in fact, being loved. The power and the beauty, I think, of that scenario is evident. But interestingly, in that very same scenario, I think a big problem is evident, and we have to just kind of look right at it. And that problem, it seems to me, is this. Am I really dependent upon others in that profound a way? Do I really depend upon other persons to empower me to be able to be myself, to empower me to be able to do that in which my own happiness will consist, namely to love well? Am I dependent upon others? Well, I'm going to come straight at you and say, I think that the answer to that question is yes. Yes. We are dependent. For sure, I would say this to you, for sure, we are dependent on other persons. Maybe in God's providence, it's not an absolute dependence on other human persons, but for sure, our ability to be ourselves and to learn how to love is absolutely dependent upon our being loved by other persons. But in God's providence, in God's amazing and ever-challenging plan, I think it's fair to say that those persons normally are going to be human persons. And again, let's be direct. Can God find other ways to convey to us what ultimately is his message to us of our lovability? And the answer to that is yes. But isn't it amazing that in his plan, the normal and natural way that our lovability, our self-image is conveyed to us is precisely by other human persons having that role of being able to be God's messenger, as it were, God's instrument to convey to us the source of who we are. For God's love, of course, is that source. It is the pulsing creative power of all of our existence. But in his normal providence, that needs to be conveyed to us by other human persons. God knows that we need to know his love. And I'd like to then face directly the problem. What do we do? What should our approach be if we experience ourselves as being in the situation of being able to say, in some real sense, the instruments that could have, should have conveyed certain things to us, in some sense, have fallen short of doing so. So what am I to do now? Is this to be an excuse now for me that I just look and say, well, someone should have shown me, someone should have told me, they haven't, and so now this is not my problem, or it's my problem, but it's not my fault. I want to look this directly in the eye. And what I'd like to suggest here is, even if the natural instruments of showing us God's love have not done all that they could have done, this too is somehow part of his loving plan for us. And he is absolutely still working to convey to us, if we are willing to look and see other ways that he is seeking to tell us. For one thing is sure, God has many ways of showing us how he loves us if we will but look. And so we must be willing, I would suggest, again, just kind of face the ugliness right at it. If we find ourselves in that circumstance of feeling unloved and unlovable, that we look this in the face and we say, I'm going to stop believing the lie. I am going to stop the cycle. And one thing I know is in my power is I'm going to just start loving. I will just start loving even though I don't feel empowered to do that. And one thing I think we should be absolutely convinced of, in that context of our being willing to just start and try, if nothing else has worked, our being willing to just start and move forward will be the context in which, at last, we will be able to see what God has the whole time been moving to convey to us. What I'd like to turn to now is the issue more specifically of friendship. How are we to form habits of being together with friends? How are we to form habits of being together with friends? I'd like to put the problem to you this way. We in our culture, I think, are losing the ability to be with people. I know it's hard to say this in words, it's hard to convey this problem, but I think that you might all be able to tune in and kind of relate to what I'm saying here. We are moved by the culture we're in to constantly be living in a kind of exterior forum. We're in a very noisy, busy, fast-moving environment. Why is it that it seems to be so difficult simply to do the thing that, in fact, we're most made for doing, to slow down and to be with, in the presence of, people? This is a real challenge for us, and I think the only way that we're going to be able to do it is by stopping and realizing that we have the problem, and realizing that the only way that we're going to be able to really learn how to be with, to live in the presence of those that we love, is to make a concerted and intentional effort to realize this has to be the object of a project. And to help us on that project, I'd like to turn to look at a few points from the great tradition of friendship and what it is, to help us understand that a little better, because it is with our friends that we will most want to practice doing precisely this living together, this being in the presence. According to Aristotle and St. Thomas, there are three kinds of actions of friendship. Three kinds of actions of friendship. I'll give you their original names, and then I'll give the names that more correspond to how we use the language now. Benevolence, beneficence, and concord. These come directly from St. Thomas's beautiful treatment of what friendship is. Benevolence, beneficence, and concord. Put otherwise, benevolence means good willing. Beneficence means good deeds or good doing. Concord, very beautiful word, literally means living with one heart. Living with one heart. So he says, these are three things that characterize true friendship. True friends have goodwill towards one another. This goes back to our opening point of the masterpiece of true love. They have looked to the other, whom they know for who he or she is, and truly love the other person. That's kind of the foundation of the friendship. Then, beneficence. They act out that love. Wherever there is true love, and this is a key test of true love, wherever there's true love, they will follow upon that beneficence. Namely, I will act for that other's goodness. If I really love you, what more sure way do I have of showing that than to do everything I can to make you truly happy, to help you truly be yourself? This is what beneficence is. It is literally working for the good of that other person. Therein you feel the power of the real love in that acting it out, of actually helping the other person to thrive. But then the third, and the one that I'd like to just focus a little bit of attention on, with this simple word, concord, living with one heart. This literally means doing good things together in love. There is a very beautiful notion here of friendship. This is really my favorite part of it, where what do we want most of all? When we love, we want to be with the other and to share our life together. We want to live together, one in heart. Here are some words from St. Thomas Aquinas. Friendship consists in some kind of sharing together, but people share themselves with one another, especially by living together. Hence, living together seems to be most proper and pleasing to friendship. It's funny, when I first studied this, I thought, there's more often going on when people that are in love move in with one another and start living together. You got to watch that phrase, living together. There's often more going on than we realize. It is the natural drive of true love to want to be together. I'm not saying everyone who moves in together are doing it because they're truly in love. I'm just saying there is this interesting dynamic of we do want to be with and to share our life together. Of course, at the end of the day, there's ways of doing that well where we are truly able to share of life, and there's ways that we're not. I love, by the way, and I always think of on just this simple point of here is where life is most happening, just being able in some way to be with those that we love. It brings to mind a story, it's one of my own favorite ones, of my children. When I was trying to teach my son about heaven, he was quite young. I think I was preparing him for First Communion. And I tried to explain to him what heaven would be like. You don't realize how difficult it is to understand such things until you try to explain it to a child. And here I am trying to, he's looking at me with his big eyes and things that I take for granted. Well, it's going to be so exciting because we're going to be with God. Interestingly, he has no notion, really, of how being with God would be good. Right, so how am I supposed to explain? Well, it's just going to be so exciting to get to be with God. And, of course, God at this point is not. So I started thinking of other things to try to say. Well, you know, all these other people you know will be there and we'll be able to do these great things. And he honestly looked at me and he said, Daddy, all I know is if you and Mama are there, I'll be happy. You know, that changed my life. It changed my understanding of what life is about. The amazing insight of that child. Isn't that, doesn't it capture the whole relationship between us and God? All it's ultimately about is being together. But in God's great plan, being together is rich, and it requires much. It's not as, well, in a sense it is as simple, but it's not as simple as it seems. But we need to remember that's what it is about. How can we achieve true being together? Ladies and gentlemen, that is the issue of friendship. What really brings people together and empowers them to live life together? At this point, we can't go into it in its fullness, but a key insight that we have to have a confidence in, even if we don't completely see it, is that ultimately, the only way to really be together is to be together in God's loving plan. In our following His loving call to us, that is the plan for how to live together. But let's look just a little bit more at this, the challenge that we have in trying to live together. Now, to bring it a little bit more back down, to just think about cultivating friendships among ourselves. Here we are in a world that is so fast, is so busy, is so overburdened. How are we to find ways of being together in richer ways? Well, I'd like to focus here quickly on another beautiful aspect of Aristotle and St. Thomas's understanding of friendship, and that is, very beautifully, they say at the heart of any true friendship is conversation. A friendship is most of all lived in rich conversation. Here's a line from St. Thomas that will give you a little bit of a kick. He's talking about the living together of friends. What's following on what we had just, the point we had just said of, well, we want to be together. Now he's getting more specific. This takes place through constant association and the exchange of thoughts and reflection. In this way, men are said to dwell with one another in an appropriate manner, not as cattle feeding together, but as human beings living a life that is proper to them. Now, this is interesting, ladies and gentlemen, because, of course, you know, cattle don't only feed together, they do other things together. There are things that could be thought to bring people together, but at and in God's plan, there are different ways that humans come together. But at the heart of real friendship, and I think those of us who are married can particularly give witness to this, wherein is our marriage most alive? When are we most alive in our marriage? We're most alive in our marriage in our conversation. Conversation, real conversation, when we learn finally how to do it, is where we are really able to be together. Maybe that conversation doesn't involve many words, but a rational presence together with one another. This is the richness, and I warn my young students, I say, if those words strike you as odd and you find yourself saying, really? Is that where we're most alive? I just warn, remember, you might not be seeing it yet because of a certain inexperience. Perhaps we have not yet tasted that which we can yet do. The real joy of real conversation of those who love one another and know one another is something, ladies and gentlemen, I'm suggesting it's a problem in the sense of a challenge we need to cultivate. And I'd like to throw out at you just a couple of aspects of that challenge and a couple of quick suggestions, and we'll go to our third challenge. Why today will this presence through conversation be particularly difficult? There's a number of different things we can point to. I'm going to point to two quick, very concrete, practical things. One, we have lost the natural contexts for good conversation. We have lost the natural contexts for good conversation. This might seem to be, well, is that really that big a deal? I'd like to throw out at you, I think it is. Just last night, my wife and I were on the way to a little event, and we drove down a little side country road, and there, sitting on the porch, it was like out of an old picture, were some old people sitting in a rocking chair on the porch. You know, and it jumped out at us. It jumped out at us because of how unusual it is. And it's so easy for us just to think, well, you know, gosh, you know, those kind of quaint habits of your, I'd like to throw the challenge at you. We need to find contexts like that. We live in a culture that is shockingly lonely. We're so connected, connected in so many ways. And we are so desperate for real personal communion. The natural contexts for these things have been lost, and we are going to have to find them because nobody is going to do it for us. So we're going to have to figure that one out in our homes, in our communities, in our parishes. What can we try to do to set up those natural contexts where people can have this kind of rich conversation? And another one is, it's a topic that I think deserves a lot more attention than we're going to give it right now, but I'm just going to throw it out there. The problem of technology. Interestingly, Pope Francis raised this rather dramatically in his encyclical, and I just want to look at it with you for just a moment. I'd put it to you this way. The technology of communication, the technology of entertainment. A very strong case can be made, ladies and gentlemen, that it cheapens our communication. It cheapens our ability to express ourselves and to be with other people. And I'd like to just throw a challenge at you there. It deserves much more discussion. It could be a whole topic in itself. How are we going to respond in a situation where we're forced to have all of this technology? In many ways, we're forced to have it in our lives. But at the same time, it is constantly kind of tearing at the fundamental human ability to be with and present to other people. Side note, do you know, ladies and gentlemen, that university counseling offices are going to have to be equipped now to have the counselors hear the problems of their students by texting, because they're finding that the students don't know how to express their problems otherwise. And it sounds freakish. You and I need to do something about that, at least in our own relationships, in our own communities. That is actually a key part of our knowing how to be together in friendship. Let's go ahead and turn to our third area here. The challenge of avoiding the possibility of sexual desire distorting our vision of love. In any consideration of friendship and love, an important issue there is this really rather amazing aspect of God's design. How does romantic feelings and sexual desire fit with friendship? How does the whole realm of the romantic fit together with friendship? It's an absolutely dramatic issue, one that we cannot give any type of full consideration here, but two things I'd like to take as given and then focus on the second. The first I'd like to take as given, which is not our topic, but I'd like to say it, is in marriage, romantic feelings and sexual desire can and must be integrated into true friendship. And ladies and gentlemen, when that's achieved, it's stunningly beautiful. When the whole realm of the romantic, the whole realm of sexual inclination can be integrated into the true friendship of marriage. Something absolutely beautiful is achieved. And it's something to be grateful for. Whether in God's providence we have that in our lives, or perhaps we wonder at it in the lives of others. The second point that I'd like to take for granted is that romantic feelings and sexual desires, when circumstances demand that they not be completed in this particular friendship, whether right now or maybe never, do constitute a real challenge, sometimes a fundamental hindrance. But let's take a closer look at that and consider a couple of aspects of how we might deal with that. Often, in my trying to reckon with these things, I've been around people in college for over 20 years. One thing that I do have to try to convey, and it's very hard for young people to see this, is once you have expressed a romantic interest in somebody, there is now a new element where it will not be the same anymore. We can't just say, all right, we're just going to treat this as a completely, quote, normal, non-romantic friendship. Once the realm of the romantic has been introduced to the realm of the friendship, we have a whole new situation that has to be reckoned with. And frankly, in my experience, this is one of the most frustrating of human experiences, when people have to realize, you mean because there's this extra romantic interest, that means that has somehow hindered our just being normal friends? Clearly, in God's providence, that's something that we do have to reckon with, because there is a truth to that. Yes, there is a change there. Let's look at that just a little bit more here and see what we might be able to come up with. The main thing I'd like to suggest here is this gives us an avenue to consider the beauty and the importance of the virtue called chastity. So if you don't mind, I'm going to just take just a moment sidetrack to say something about this virtue. Chastity is a word, ladies and gentlemen, that's used a lot in good circles, but sometimes it's not used with precision. And I'd like to use it here with a certain precision for you, as I think that you'll appreciate this point. Sometimes chastity is used kind of like the term abstinence is used to just refer to a certain set of things that are not done. That is one way that the term can be used. But I think the richer way to use the term chastity is that it names a virtue. And it names a very positive virtue. And I'd just like to say a quick word then on what that virtue means. It is a virtue of an interior transformation, a disciplining of the very desires themselves that we have. It's not just an ability to say no to desires. The virtue of chastity is literally a transforming of our desires in the realm of sexuality. We might look at it this way. Chastity is having our sexual desires actually come into line with true love. That's such a dramatic statement, I'm going to say it to you again. The virtue of chastity in its full form is actually having transformed our sexual desires so that they are now in line with true love. In other words, that literally means that they themselves have come to be an expression of true love and will ideally not then go where true love wouldn't go. Now, I will say, in our fallen state, I think it is true to say that that is never completely achieved. But nonetheless, it is very important, I think, ladies and gentlemen, that we understand that that is what we're striving for. We all are too often told that we have to take our desires as given. Here is a key part of our tradition that is saying to us, in fact, by the grace of God especially, we can be working on transforming them. And our ideal is to continue to make progress in that direction. Ladies and gentlemen, this is not a formula then for guilt about not having succeeded in transforming the desires. This is in no way questioning the fundamental theological principle that we don't have to, for instance, feel guilty about having bad desires. But nonetheless, this is a very empowering truth of we nonetheless are working to transform them. That is our goal in chastity. And if we know that that's our goal, then we are setting our eyes on that when we make ourselves a practical plan. My main suggestion, and many others better than me have addressed this, I would just say this: for sure, we need to have a plan to grow in chastity. If there's truth to what we just said that virtue is, then that means that is the object of our personal chastity plan. One thing we know for sure, nobody ever becomes chaste by accident. It's only when we have made it the object of intention and a plan. If everyone has their own suggestions for particular things, I'm just going to name two that I like to consider as an important part of anyone's chastity plan. The one is that beautiful old line, custody of the eyes. I just love to say the phrase, just to think about achieving it. Custody of the eyes. It's a goal. It's an ideal. It's a practice. What a way of honoring people to be able to have custody of our eyes. And the second suggestion as regard to chastity plan is using Scripture. Use the Word of God to transform our desires, not just to fight temptation, but to transform our desires. The Word of God is creative. It can create anew our desires. So we have a general principle here that chastity, then, in the sense just discussed as a virtue, is what enables, empowers, and protects relationships. This is precisely what enables us to have friendships, even where there is that challenge of romantic desire. To the extent that we are succeeding, to the extent that we are earnestly and honestly trying to cultivate this virtue that we just named in chastity, it is the empowerer of friendship, even in the context of romantic desire. Now, prudential judgment is still going to have to govern this realm. And sometimes, and I know many others know this better than I do, I think it's beautiful just to stop and recognize, in honor of those who have achieved it, it's important to recognize, ladies and gentlemen, that sometimes, given certain circumstances, prudence would say it will be better not to have any exercise of this friendship. That prudence, given certain circumstances, will dictate that we cannot really spend time together. And it just seems to me that there are few things that are more beautiful than a person who is willing to look at another and say, because I love you, because I love you, I withdraw myself. How unbelievably honorable that is. It is truly worthy of honor. I'd just like to wrap up then, ladies and gentlemen. Every true friendship is a participation in the creative power of God's love. Every true friendship is a participation in the creative power of God's love. It brings vision, it brings life, it brings joy. And every true friendship, even and maybe perhaps especially those that for various circumstances could not in action continue in this life, every true friendship will come to its fruition where in Christ in the next life we will all be together always. Thank you very much for your attention.
So we do have some time for Q&A. We've got plenty of time actually. So, and it can be about hunting or bacon too. Okay.
Making bacon. Father, shall I drive or?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, sir.
That once the realm of romantic desire is introduced into a friendship, it needs to be reckoned with. Like, what would be an example? How could two people reckon with that in a way that would allow them to continue their friendship in a healthy way?
I'm going to repeat the question. The question said that I had said that once romantic feelings enter into a friendship, that has to be reckoned with. The question is, how might that be reckoned with, and then the friendship continue? That is a loaded question. Loadedly good question. I'd say I want to admit my inexperience. This is where I tremble to pretend to be able to address certain things that I know people in this room can address much better than I can. So I'm not going to pretend to be able to do what I can't. What is my area? What I'm constantly dealing with is particularly young men who have fallen in love with a young lady, who have told the young lady that they love her, have expressed some interest, and then they find, oh my goodness, but now this our relationship, which before that was just fine, now we've got a problem. And see, this is what I deal with all the time. And you see how there's a common principle between that and a number of other things, obviously, that we could talk about. So it very much depends upon the circumstances, right? Here's the key thing. We always need to go back to principles. The realm of the romantic is a gift from God that is intrinsically ordered to marriage. The romantic has no place except as preparing for marriage or in marriage. And am I saying those words? I tremble because of the group I'm talking to. I mean, I say that so easily. And I understand how that can be for other people. But nonetheless, we have to focus on the truth of the matter. So this is why I brought up the distinction. If what do I say to the young men in those circumstances? Look, you have to ask yourself, is marriage a proximate possibility? Is it or isn't it? If it's not a proximate a possibility, then you've got to cut it. You can't, it's unfair to her if you are in any way proceeding to cultivate your romantic relationship, because this can't go anywhere right now, and that a man of integrity will not do that. But, okay, that said, we have, again, how do we say? First of all, can they still, particularly given, what was the point? But nonetheless, you're asking me reasonably, give me some payoff, sir, to what you said about chastity. All right, this is what you're saying to me, and this is all right. So let me try my best here. All right, when push comes to shove, we can't apply this. Thanks a lot for your lecture. All right, I understand. Now I know what you're saying to me. To the extent that we are chaste, it makes it more possible, for instance, to be able to be in a friendship where I will be able to veil or in any case appropriately restrain the romantic and still have a relationship, right? Romantic feelings can break out in so many different ways. Married people, I say this as a married man, we all know that you can still have romantic feelings towards someone that you're not married to. How does one do that? First of all, again, I say the virtue of chastity is the great protector. To the extent that I am chaste, that will actually allow me to be able to have reasonable friendships with ladies other than my wife, because I can be trusted. I can be trusted to put order into my romantic tendencies and restrain them and still focus on the other person in a non-romantic way, which I am called to do unless it is going to be marital, right? So the virtue of chastity empowers me to do that. And so there are a number of contexts where you can, again, particularly to the extent that we're succeeding in being chaste, precisely do that. And that can come in various levels of we have a common understanding, we both have this further interest, but we both understand that we're saying no to that, so here's where we are, right? This comes in many different shapes. Am I helping a little more now? Am I addressing the question? Yes, sir. Yes, sir. White shirt.
Yeah, I'm really intrigued about this because I think the society doesn't know how to date, and the society doesn't know how to court, and what is the line between dating and courtship?
Right.
And how do you instill something that makes absolutely no sense to anyone?
Right. I'm supposed to give the prize for the most difficult question. Okay. All right. I just took it away from him. I'm sending it out to you. Yes, Lord help us. We have a culture that focuses on me and self-gratification, and that the essence of integrity is putting the other person first and looking to the other person's good, even when it hurts. And so it's easier for me to speak about this from the viewpoint of a man, not from having achieved it, as having, by the grace of God, at least something of a clear sense of what I'm trying to achieve as a man. And a man is particularly always called upon to be restraining his desires and seeing what the true good of the other person is and putting that first and acting according to that in integrity. So what we need to be doing is trying to train the youth to say, these desires you have, they are good. They have their place. But if you don't look and you don't understand what's going on here, then you are going to end up being selfish. You might not even realize it, but you're putting yourself first. You're moving too quickly. You're actually asking something for yourself rather than being willing to give. One of the biggest mistakes I think that young men make is they actually think they're loving the other person by saying, I love you. Whereas very often, to express romantic interest is in fact a way of drawing the other person to yourself for your own sake. And this, very often, I think honestly, again, I talk to young men the most, young men do not realize that that's what's going on. They have a natural inclination. When they fall in love, they want to express it. So I want to start dating. I want to start being with you. I mean, I want to tell you all about it. But all of that has a certain place that it's going. And if it's not time, if I as a man am not ready to follow up on that, and this is marriage is not proximate. Proximate is just Latin for close. If it's not reasonably close, then in fact I'm being selfish by drawing you into something that I can't follow through on. So just expressing my love or my desire there is in fact not an act of integrity. But again, this is far away. This is it's very hard in a culture of selfish gratification, but that, it seems to me, is to go back to the kind of basic principle there. I just throw that at you. Yes, sir.
Thank you for beautifully presenting a very beautiful topic.
Thank you.
My question is about just friendship, not romance.
Right.
I find that in today's culture, male friendships, male-female friendships are very difficult. Because everyone assumes the sexual element always. Like, if you want to be
right.
my friendship, if you want to be a friend, you must have some sexual interest. Or male, they're kind of afraid. They pull back quite a bit because, oh, we don't want to be seen as being homosexual. Could you address that a little bit?
This is a fabulous, fabulous point. I would that we could just talk about this together at length. And again, the wisdom of others in this room, I'm sure, could help us a lot. I wrestle with this directly because one of the main things that I say to the young people, the youth groups, is I say, friendship is, this fits with our theme of today, friendship itself is so demanding that it's best to learn the habits of it. Now allow me, this is how I say it. And again, I'm in a context that's different from this context. I'm just going to tell you how I say it and then help me fix it as we need to fix it, if I may just say it that way. What I say is, you need to learn the habits of friendship in same-sex relationships first, where you don't have the challenge of the romantic. And then, once you have the habits of friendship, then you can proceed to those relationships where there will be the added challenge of the romantic. And I completely agree that one of the biggest problems of youth male culture is that they don't know how to be friends with other men, and men need other men to show them how to be men and to sharpen one another on. And so they're immediately following their passions. And maybe at this point now, as our culture now, passions can go one way or the other. In a sense, it's then kind of same. If a man follows his passions, kind of his romantic sexual inclinations, that is always going to be a problem when that's coming in before fundamental habits of true, unselfish love in integrity have been learned. And I completely agree that is best done, first of all, in same-sex relationships. And God grant that we can still, and maybe it's people in this room that can give a special witness to the true beauty and power of virtuous same-sex relationships, if I may put it that way. Is that reasonable? Sir.
To your point about texting, I completely agree with you, and I heard a lot of sadness and frustration with us in the room, especially when we're trying to communicate our feelings and emotions. I recently, I had the experience of spending some family time, especially with my nieces and nephews who are like 20, 21, 23. And they're all sitting in the living room texting each other. And I'm sure we all have that common experience, but my unique experience in that whole texting business was I was able to have conversations with my niece who had a lot of trauma throughout her childhood, a lot of abuse, a lot of neglect, a lot of stuff that I was able to text her certain things. She was able to text certain responses that were safe for both of us.
Right.
And it reminded me, like as I thought about how I was going to phrase my question to you or statement to you, it reminded me a little bit of the sixth sense where the fellow, I forget his name, the fellow who ended up being dead. He and then the boy, the little boy, if he said something right, the boy would move a little closer. But then the minute that he started saying something wrong, or he wasn't making sense, or the boy began to distrust him, he started to go further away. But then if he said something right, he would gently come back again. And my point in this is that in the new evangelization, especially with courage and the end courage apostolate, in moving forward with our message, we have to meet folks where they
absolutely.
Are, especially our youth. If that's what they're doing, we have to be creative enough and pray enough and allow the Holy Spirit to even work through that silly texting of theirs.
I agree. I agree. I appreciate your point, man. I'm going to say this to you. There's no easy answer to this. Absolutely. For evangelizing, I started a blog. And I started it when I realized that a number of my former students that were young parents and they were struggling out there, they just said, honestly, Dr. Cutterback, it's all that we find in our life that we have time to read. And so we have to live where we are. But I absolutely, at the same time, I'm going to come back to you and say we need to read again what Pope Francis suggested about the technocratic paradigm. And one of the main things he suggested there is certain technologies have an enduring negative influence. And we have to be aware of that. And somehow it's left to us to figure this out. I tremble when I think of the households where people are texting to one another. Now, if that's the case, and if it's the only way that's going to be reached, if one of my own children, the only way that's going to reach that child is by texting him, by God, I'm going to text my child. But that doesn't mean that I'm not going to try in my household to say, in this household, please, we're going to turn those off, and we're going to look at one another in the face, and we're going to do something here that is profoundly human to the extent that we can, not for the sake of leaving other people out or standing in judgment, but I just am convinced that there's something critically human that we should be still trying to preserve over against it. Somehow, I think you and I are called upon to be doing those both of those things at the same time. Yes, sir. I'm sorry, please. Thank you, sir.
Question. It's about friendship.
Good.
I think you said that what we need to learn to do is to put the other person first and make them happy and do things for their benefit. But my experience is that I tend to overdo that, and then the other person doesn't do that. And it doesn't work. It's very imbalanced.
That's a great question.
I'm not going to be able to give a sufficient answer to that. I will nonetheless be bold and make a suggestion. I certainly am aware that there's a such thing as having too great a need to please, and it actually coming from a lack of security that we're always trying to kind of win the affection of the other by seeking to please. And that, which can look a lot like putting the other first, I think in fact is not. And so this is where the virtue of prudence has to come in, or perhaps even counseling, where we have to recognize that we have to, there's a book called Boundaries, where you have to recognize my boundaries have to be respected. We have to have a sense of who we are, and not be seeking to please out of trying to scrape somehow a self-image out of it. Rather, true love, of course, is coming from a position of a greater strength, a greater security that we already have, kind of secure in God's love, we're able to go and reach out. So, ma'am, you ask a fantastic question where there can be a problem, and something that could look like true love wouldn't be, and that would have to be reckoned with. If you don't mind, I will just nonetheless throw out, and this might not be what you're referring to, but I don't think you'll mind my just saying, I will say from my own experience of marriage, there is this interesting moment that could in any case sound like something you were referring to, where sometimes I am trying to look at my wife and love her, and those challenging moments where you're not feeling that you're getting it back at a particular moment, and there's this kind of terror But if I keep giving now and I don't get it back, I'm going to kind of, I'll drop out of here. No one, if I don't put me first, and it so happens that my beloved misses my good at this moment, it's going to be missed. Who's going to think about it? And I just think at those key moments, that's where we're most tried. And that's where that key line of it's got to be 100-100, not 50-50. We have to be willing to just go ahead and give it all and just have confidence that somehow, in God's providence, it will come back. That's just something that came to my mind in your good question. But thank you.
Thank you.